Hello, welcome to another... Is this the podcast with a K? Is this Beyond Casterbrus? I'm never quite sure. It's Beyond Casterbrus, I think, really, isn't it?
It's beyond me.
It's beyond me as well. Beyond caring. Beyond cast... No, it doesn't work, does it?
Beyond
saying.
Today
we're just going to chat, I think. We've been... I suppose the polite way, we've just been bitching about life before I hit record, in general, which I'm sure, depending on when this goes out, I think a lot of people are bitching about life for various reasons, and we're not going to sort of dwell or focus on any of them. I'm sure you've all got your real reasons for bitching about life. Life is tough, life is hard. I was just saying that I think 1998 was probably one of the best years to live. I quite enjoyed 1998. Lex was going, I think. Buffy was running. TV-wise, it was quite fun, you know. Everything seemed a little, still had that 90s vague optimism before 2000s crashed us firmly onto our faces with lots of real-life horrors. So what I thought we'd talk about is maybe, if Brian agrees, what sort of things are there that... we enjoy, or what sort of things do we watch to actually either escape or just to lift the mood when you're having a downtime? I mean, that's sort of where I know that's where I am at the moment, and I think that's where Brian is to a degree as well, is that we sort of look for things to watch to escape sort of pressures, be they on our personal situations, maybe they're political, maybe they're social, personal, you know. So we're not trying to sort of specify anything specifically, just that when things are getting tough and television and film generally are known as escapist properties, what sort of things do we look for in our escapism, and what do we go, and maybe this might give you some ideas of where to head out yourselves.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was just going to say, was, you know, TV and films were the escape from reality. They were the escapism. They were the thing you were supposed to suspend your disbelief to enjoy.
You said were. That's interesting. So you don't think it is so much now?
I think there are some things, but I think too much of reality has crept into our escapism, into our fiction. You know, if you look at anything, I mean, pretty much you look at most of the dramas that are out there, the dramas anymore, cop dramas, sorts of things like that, you know, war dramas, and so on. They try and make them as realistic as they can, and even watching something like The Walking Dead, you know, that it's good in a way because the danger is so real. You get such a sense of it. You feel like things are so horrible, this is terrible. You get a sense of that world, which you're supposed to get of what you're watching. You're supposed to get a sense of the world you're in. But the problem is that some things, they don't have that escapism anymore. You're essentially going from the horrible real world into your home, turning on that TV to watch the horrible real world as a scripted drama.
This is the interesting thing with as you mentioned The Walking Dead. I don't watch Walking Dead, but I have really enjoyed Z Nation, seasons 1 and 2 so far, and I've enjoyed a few other post-apocalyptic things. There are arguments out there that they say that, you know, with post-apocalyptic television, the while it's a sort of almost like the epitome of the dark future, in a sense, because it sort of exists in a world where the horror has happened, the worst has happened. In a sense, people find it almost a sort of like a comfort food, because these are people stripped down to bare essentials, where those pressures of life that you're watching, as you're watching, are no longer there. Your job no longer exists. Wondering what you're going to do in the future no longer exists. Yeah. Your mortgage no longer exists. It's just stripped down to the bare essentials. Pressures have been stripped away. And did you see what I mean? Does that sort of make sense?
Yeah, well, no, and absolutely. And even in something like The Walking Dead, mm-hmm. you know, you have the hope that the heroes are still fighting for good.
Yes, that's true. It's not directionless.
Right. And like, you know... both of us have talked about The X-Files before and our interest in that show and so on. And, you know, you have Mulder basically fighting the government. And right now, I mean, the government's a mess. You know, and you have Mulder fighting the government, but there's always that hope that he's going to fight for the truth, that he's going to do something to save the day. You know, and it's a little bit different watching that versus watching something like The West Wing, which also has government and issues with the government and so on. And I mean, it's odd to say, because there are just a lot of, I mean, I'm probably finding bad examples, certainly even with The Walking Dead, but I just find that a lot of things that are on, I'm sitting there saying, where's my escapism? I just want some silly fun, which is why, you know, I enjoy a lot of the Marvel films.
Yeah.
You know, I think we got to talk a little bit about the fact that I was listening to the Hitchhikers radio dramas, because I think Hitchhikers is just a fun story. We have talking about things that we're watching to escape the reality.
Yes, absolutely.
Trying to get the word out for the show. Who Would I Lie to You? Which, okay, you and Christian had kind of said, you know, like things like that, like a TV show where people, their goal is to be silly, their goal is to make you laugh. You know, it's a game show, yeah, there are rules, but that, you know, they'll throw them out the window for the joke, and that's fun, and you forget things because they're just making you laugh, you know. My wife is very into Seinfeld, so we watch a lot of Seinfeld, and it is silly, because what Seinfeld did so well was take a lot of those crazy, ridiculous things of the world and turn them on their head to make them over, as crazy as they are, sound outrageous for a sitcom plot, you know, and found a way to kind of tell us how horrible something is through just showing us how horrible it is.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And somehow it was still funny, rather than just being completely awful. I don't know. It's such a weird thing. Rather than like taking something like Schindler's List and watching that as your form of entertainment. I think Schindler's List is great. I think it informs a lot of people of what things were like, and I think, you know, I certainly won't and can't say anything bad about it, but I do think that if you're going to go home from a long day of work, or actually certainly watching Nazis here in America make their stand, what would that be doing to help you with your day? You know, I don't know. It's difficult. It's very difficult for me to even like stay on the flow here with the proper answer, just because I am just so taken aback by everything right now. I guess I don't know where else to go with that.
I mean, I think the answer obviously is there is no singular definitive one that covers every mood. I mean, there'll be times where if I watched a sort of, as we said, a post-apocalyptic, it might be just too much. Not that it, you know, scary or tense, but it might be just too lacking a certain freeness, that there is a certain passage of tension. And as you say, the game shows are often are very good. I used to like Whose Line Is It Anyway? And I still do.
Oh, yeah.
And they're peripheral everywhere in the UK. The old British ones are all on all four. You know, you can find it in most places. And I, you know, Ryan Stiles, Colin Mochrie, you know, absolutely fantastic improvisers, which take you far away from everything else. They are so abstract. Like Would I Lie to You, which is a show which, if you don't know, is a panel show where two teams have to sort of try and guess whether the one person on the other team is actually spinning a lie or a truth. It's as simple as that. But if you've got the right people there, it's escapism, isn't it? It frees you out and takes you away from all those problems. And maybe things like game shows work particularly well, because our problems aren't always the same. Like you say, it could be a political or a social issue. Sometimes you just need to escape because you've got a romantic problem, or yeah, you know, a friend problem. And sometimes then sitting and watching a sitcom, you know, where you've got five episodes of someone wanting to get with someone, or a situation which might mirror your own, you might not want to see. But you don't tend to get that in the old panel show. The panel show is nicely stripped away from all those levels of stress.
I'm glad you said panel show there, because I was just going to say game shows, unfortunately, to me, are definitely not the escape anymore. Because when I watch these panel shows, and so that people have an idea here, maybe in America, if you don't know what Would I Lie to You is, it's very much like the old Match Game or Hollywood Squares. where basically celebrities just sit on a panel and they are playing a game. It's like sitting at home and playing Cards Against Humanity or Trivial Pursuit, and just, you know, everything's a joke, turning everything into a joke, you know, finding the funny in every answer, you know, and to be entertaining. And it's just great. It's just celebrities doing what they do, entertaining, and it's fun.
And there's the camaraderie factor, which is, I don't know whether this is mutated over in the States, but it certainly did over here. The Have I Got News For You sort of format, where you say you have celebrities on the teams rather than contestants. The points don't matter, the points are superfluous.
Yeah.
It's about, as you say, the interaction, but it's also about there being a sort of like a set base of what's the word, in situ celebrities who are there each week, which create a sort of almost like a family dynamic.
Yeah.
So in Who I Have they're all such annoying faces. Would I Lie to You? You have that dynamic between David Mitchell, Lee Mack, and Rob Brydon, which, and the way that they all play off each other and tease each other, gives you that family feel within that, what was, as you say, used to be that sort of contestant-based, quite restricted. Every week was a new set of celebrities. Who would you come to see would be on the show, if we're talking Celebrity mm-hmm. Squares. But it isn't quite like that. And I suppose Whose Line Is It Anyway was a sort of earlier version of that, where there was a little bit of that, some camaraderie, but there was that setup of there being Ryan Stiles, Colin Mochrie. There were sort of people who were always on it, and the points, again, didn't matter. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And basically, I mean, when you think about it, what's sad to me is thinking about American TV and our kind of panel shows. You know, I gave examples of The Match Game and Hollywood Squares and so on. And there was even another one. I can't remember the name of it, but it was basically celebrity couples, and you were trying to find out how well they knew each other, kind of thing.
God.
And it was all about. Yeah, you know, it was great. But what I realized was, the only modern equivalent that I can think of, and maybe somebody has a better example for me, but is Whose Line Is It Anyway? And we got that from you.
Mm.
You know, like the American version that played over here was celebrity guests every week playing the game for the points that don't matter for our entertainment. You know, because where I was going with this was, it's a shame. I would like to see more panel shows like that, because I would like to see how celebrities of today kind of would do that and goof around and joke. And we don't really have that. And it would be fun to see how far it could go, how high up the celebrity chain, I guess, it could go. Because I'll be honest, most of the celebrities on TV here, I don't know who they are now.
Yes,
I know British celebrities more. It's kind of weird. But the thing that I was going to say was, game shows are not an escape anymore, because there used to be a time when you could sit down, you could watch The Family Feud, or you could watch The Wheel of Fortune, and maybe The Wheel of Fortune isn't all that entertaining to watch just as a TV show, but, you know, figuring out puzzles for fun, it was fine, you know. But Family Feud always had some good entertainment in it. It was always families trying to just earn some extra cash by trying to guess the best possible answers, you know. But nowadays, game shows, it's the reality TV curse. Game shows aren't fun anymore. They're the person, okay, you watch Family Feud, you think you're having fun watching these people like play this game, and you're at home guessing these things and getting all excited because they're winning money. But they're having more fun because there they are on stage playing the game and winning the money. But then you watch something like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, you know, and it's like they're not having fun. Those people are up there sweating bullets, because if they get an answer wrong, they've just lost half of the $50,000 that they just won by getting an answer right. You know, and the drama, the thing that makes people come back to watch that show is watching those people fail, is watching those people sweat. Nobody's watching it to hope that they get $1 million.
Very true.
People are so much more interested now in people's failure than they ever are their success.
There's a negative investment.
Yeah,
I think
that's the sad thing.
I think maybe as well, I mean, as television has changed, obviously moving away from it being sort of so much linear. Well, it's not so much the way it's broadcast or narrowcast, it's more how we watch it. As when I think of Family Feud, or as it was called over here, Family Fortunes, I always see that as being something that a family would sit down and watch. You know, it was a representing, it was a family watching a family almost. It was a sort of back in the 80s or so. It had that sort of feeling, which you don't tend to have as much now. And yeah, I'm not keen on game shows. I certainly never watch it. I find them vaguely depressing, sure, to be honest. I'm not quite sure why. Whether it's because they're too structured, that if I sit and I watch one, if I don't know what it's about, I have to work out what it is, and that's frustrating. Once I do work out what it is, because there's nothing really to really engage me there, because no offence to contestants, but, you know, they're not television material, because they're not television material, which is why they're contestants. So there's not enough dynamic there to really sort of pull me in. So I get frustrated, so it doesn't take away pressures. While, as you say, panel shows, there is automatically a certain level of discourse which is going to be enjoyable, yeah, because they are professional at doing just that. So
exactly.
Absolutely, I totally agree with you. The panel show is a brilliant example of, and a wonderful one, because it's one that I hadn't thought of when we came into this, that probably is the epitome of when you just want to escape everything. The panel show is probably the safest bet.
Well, and you know what's great too, watching, and I agree with you, like, I don't really watch game shows. They were the good thing when you just needed a couple of mindless minutes watching something, you know what I mean? But mm-hmm. panel shows are great because not only are they just silly and entertaining, but they can go ahead and tackle the current event things that you're trying to avoid in such a way that makes you sit there and enjoy it. You know, like they're saying the things that are on your mind in a way that you can laugh it off and maybe blow off some steam with it. You know, and it's a great pleasure. It's a very great escape to sit there and watch a panel show. And I say that maybe because, you know, when we're looking for something to escape with, as we kind of started this with, my go-to shows, you know, sometimes you're just not always in the mood to watch the same episode or the same show over and over again. Or if there's two of you watching, you're not in the mood to watch the same thing at the same time. But when you find something you can click on, like these panel shows, it's great. It's fun. They're just mindless because there's no story to follow. There's no, you know, I missed last episode, I'm not going to understand what's going on this episode. There's no new characters to get to know. It's just people. You're just watching literal people, you know, that are not scripted. They're who they are, just being funny. but at the same time, too, there are other things. And I'll be honest, it's kind of funny. Like, to escape reality, my wife will turn to Seinfeld. She'll turn to Taxi, That 70s Show, you know, all sorts of comedy TV shows and so on. But my escape from reality is usually any form of science fiction or superhero drama or something like that. And you know, I will escape gladly into the world of the X-Files. And, you know, they can have some pretty heavy concept episodes or heavy drama episodes, certainly in Mulder and Scully's life. But then you can get an episode where there's fun and silly things going on, or just a good scary monster, you know. But it's interesting just to see how different people will escape reality. And, you know, there's, and like we were talking about with Schindler's List or something else earlier on, somebody else's escape from reality is watching those heavy-handed dramas that are very true to reality, you know, just because that engages their mind.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. And that's what it's really about. What engages your mind? What gets you motivated enough to be interested and entertained for the hour or two that you're going to sit there watching this drama, this movie?
That's the other question, isn't it? Is your duration span? Because, I mean, a lot of people, including myself, sometimes the escapism is just getting heavily invested in something because you and let it take up your time, which is obviously the epitome of the binge watching. So you might find you get invested in something which is quite dark, but because it's engaging, it's so engaging, it just pulls you in and you just watch the one after the other, after the other, after the other, which is something the X-Files obviously can do because you've got a large catalogue. And so that could be binge watched. So yeah, like I say, I think it's very key. It's key. Don't think anyone's going to argue with us on this podcast because it's fairly light, but the key is that you're not saying there's any specific way or a specific answer, because everyone is different. But I think it's interesting just analysing what sort of things might be the things which we look for when we're in certain types of mood. And I think that, I mean, I quite like, if I don't have much time, I'm feeling exceptionally pressured by world events, I might drop into something like one of the streamers, Now TV, had Futurama, had all the seasons there, and I just started. I didn't have much time in the days at the moment, so I'd just sit down with my food. 30 minutes with that was far better than sitting and reading The Guardian or the Independent newspaper and seeing the news or mulling over it. That was a nice escape because it's light. Yeah. Again, it's punching joke upon joke. You can rely on it. And it's short. Because sometimes I think one of the problems with television now is that everything, there's a lot, it feels like there's more of a disparity between well, I mean, in America, obviously, there was this, you have this bigger, you have this far more set in stone. The sort of hour long and the half hour long, and the hour right. being the drama and the half hour tending to be sort of light entertainment, well, not
typically,
always
yeah.
Sitcoms and the like, and sometimes I feel that there's not enough of those half hours, because sometimes life seems to be more about grabbing those half hours than they do those hours. So even though I might find I could really sit down and enjoy getting invested and immersed and escape in a 50 minute show, I would really like to sort of just have something quick. So one of the things I started watching on family suggestion, and I'm enjoying it in the same way that I used to enjoy the Golden Girls, was the Gilmore Girls, strangely enough. GGs. Hmm. Just again, it's a very light, it's nicely scripted, it's you know, there's nothing really happening in it, and I can, but the problem is, it's, you know, the 45-50 minute format, and The Golden Girls was, you know, take away the breaks, you're talking about 25 minutes, 22 minutes, 25 minutes. And finding something that size is nice. And I kind of liked Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt for that reason. It sort of carried a sort of fluffy awayness, but yet the duration of it being only about 25 minutes just fitted into the day better. And I kind of miss that.
You know, it's really funny, too, because talking about half-hour comedies and so on, you know, watching a half an hour episode of Seinfeld.
Yes.
I feel like it's over in 5 minutes.
Yes.
But watching a half an hour episode of The IT Crowd, it's a pretty nice length. It's still short. And then you get through six episodes and then you get through a four series, you know, and then one special. And it's like, man, where did that go? But the big difference is, and I guess The IT Crowd probably isn't the best example because I think that was Channel 4, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And it had commercials, but a half an hour of a BBC yes. comedy would be a half an hour, or at least 20-odd minutes, you know, 20, close to a half an hour, rather. An old episode of Doctor Who being 24 minutes, even though, you know, you needed more than one episode to have a full story. But it's just it's sad that when you think about it, like the brilliant comedy that a lot of American TV shows do have, that, you know, some of our gems anyway, could have really gone on for a full hour long episode, and I don't think anybody would have been upset by that, you know. But you're right. Like, I'm watching right now on Netflix, Cheers, mm-hmm. and you know, like Cheers and Night Court were like a staple when I was younger and so on, and to be honest, I've always leaned more toward Night Court, but it's not on Netflix. And Cheers is good. It's entertaining. I mean, like, virtually every scene is set in that bar, you know? Yeah. Like, and there was even a Seinfeld episode the other day where George was talking to George, the character, was talking to George Wendt, telling him, you know, hey, you know, you should get out of the bar. There's too much of the bar, you know, kind of thing, trying to give him ideas for the show. And I just thought that's funny because I was thinking this watching the show, you know. Other sitcoms will go other places, but then I thought about it, even with Night Court, they're in the courtroom, they're in his chambers, you know, like that was a sitcom, they had those sets and that was it, you know. But it's such a light, simple comedy, Cheers, that it rose to be such a popular, like, number one show over here. But you couldn't do that. I mean, some of the themes and ideas in the show, like there was one about some of the people in the bar being outraged that gay people would be in that bar and they were afraid it was going to become a gay bar and they were going to lose their home. And I watched that episode going, well, shit, you know, that's the times, you know, that that would not be today. You know, even the characters were telling Sam, you know, you get the gay people out of here or we're gone. Your regulars are gone. And I just thought, this is like, I'm surprised, you know, they ban Dukes of Hazzard because of the flag. You know, just because of the flag, like no other kind of things about it, you know, just because it generally had the Southern flag on top. But would they ban this show because one episode, or would they ban that episode? You know, who knows? Mm-hmm. But in the end, you get to the end where, like, you find out that the people that they thought were gay the entire time were not the gay people. The gay people were actually hanging around with them, pretending to be straight people, and kind of like, you know, goading them on because they thought it was funny and silly. And then the two gay guys ended up kissing George Wendt's character, what, Norm, on the cheeks. And at the end, he just made a little silly joke that it was better than Vera, and everything was fine. We're cool with the gay people. And it was just like, it was like, you know what? I don't know. Is this allowed because they saved themselves at the end that, hey, everybody's okay with it. We realized we were stupid. We had our little tiff with it, but we're cool now, or what? I don't know. But aside from that, there are episodes where the comedy is just good comedy, and it's just, yeah, it's like classic jokes about, you know, just some people, some one character just being stupid, you know, like it used to be allowed that some character was thick, so it was funny, you know. But it really doesn't matter. I like, what if even if a show has dated poorly, and like I said, maybe that one wouldn't fly today, obviously, and I don't think it should fly today, but that episode anyway. But if you watch something and you can see the humor in it, I hate to keep bringing Seinfeld up because it makes it sound like that's what I'm trying to make the podcast be about, which it's not. But I watched an interview with Jerry Seinfeld, and I forget whose show he was on, but it is one of the American talk shows right now, and I don't know all of the hosts well enough to know who this guy was, unfortunately. But Jerry was basically calling the guy out, saying, you know, I saw you make a statement that you're no longer going to joke about Caitlyn Jenner. You're not going to make any jokes. And he's like, yeah, I said that. And he's like, well, I don't think that's right. And Jerry just told the guy flat out, I don't think that's right. And he said, like, he what Jerry's point was, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant, was that nothing should be off limits. If you're a comedian, nothing should be off limits. Like, if and Jerry has said before that, like, if I didn't make a joke about something, even this horrible thing, he said, it's only because I didn't find the funny thing to say about it yet. But basically, when you're a comedian and when you're watching comedy, you have to understand that what's being said is a joke for the simple laugh. You know, it's just being said to entertain for that moment. It's not a political view. It's not a statement. It's not a belief. It's that funny jab, that funny jibe, that funny moment. So long as it is funny, so long as it is silly, and you can sit there and go, this person is being so over the top that, yes, obviously that's a joke, it should be fine. And, like, he got the host's reasoning for not wanting to joke about Caitlyn Jenner, and he felt like, you know, there are things that are certainly wrong to say or too far to say, but he said, like, I just don't think it's right that we as comedians should be limited because something might hurt somebody's feelings, or so on, like, because those people who are getting their feelings hurt aren't realizing that what's being said is not a hurtful thing aimed at you, meant to hurt you. You know, like, I would joke my entire life, I would joke about myself just as much as I would jab at somebody else, because it was just silly to take those hits at myself and each other, because we all knew they were just silly jabs. And I think that's the thing. Like, so long as you can sit there and watch comedy and not say, yeah, I absolutely agree with that, that was great, man, that I feel like, you know, we should eliminate the gays, you know, like, then you got it, you know. But if you sit there and you agree with that statement and you think that it's some political view to follow, then you've missed it, you know. And I think comedy should be something to take your mind off of it, something to entertain you, and just make you forget the world issues at the moment, and not taken for face value. And you know, I think the best example is the comics who are what is that word, insult comics.
Yeah,
I don't get them most of the time. They're not my favorite thing, but, you know, watching even those panel shows, sometimes they will take jabs at each other because, damn, it's right there. You left that door open. I got to take it. And you see, rather than getting offended, you see the other celebrities sit there and go, oh, man, you know, I should have seen that coming. I don't blame you for taking that, you know. But insult comics, people will go see their shows hoping that they get insulted, because they find what that person says funny, because they know it's not serious. They're there for the laugh because, for whatever reason, that's their type of humor. It may not be my cup of tea. I may not always get it. Sometimes it is funny, but other people do. And I think that's just the best example. If somebody can earn their living basically making fun of people and being that rude, then there are people out there who understand that what they're doing is just a joke. They're not serious. It's not there. It was meant for some guy or some gal to get up on stage, be goofy for an hour, and do these things that they otherwise wouldn't do in reality because they don't believe them. They don't think they're true. It's just the humor for the moment.
Yeah, comedy's a difficult one like that. And I agree. I mean, I don't think comedy should really have limits. It's I think there could be an argument, I suppose, that broadcast comedy, where you're not actually, where a specific narrow band of people are not paying to go and see a comedian, so therefore you're playing it across a board of people who might not get the nuances of it.
Sure.
From a commercial point of view, I can see the logic in sort of being more careful what you broadcast. But yeah, I think you're hard pushed to say comedy should have limits. The only limits I tend to put on them, and again, I don't know if I can even put those on, is I've tend to found, like you just sort of said, that if your comedy is playing on certain attitudes that deal with sensitive issues, as long as I think that comedy is the way that comedy shouldn't, because I find the worst comedians who espouse or talk about social issues in a certain way, say race or gender, yeah, homophobia and the likes, when you feel that there is no irony there when they're playing their point, you feel that they're actually saying what they actually believe. To me, but at the same time, I have no issue with, say, I enjoy, and to be honest, this is something I do when I'm feeling a bit pressured by politics. I love watching John Oliver on his this show. I think he's great because he articulates things in a way which makes me feel he's speaking to me. But yet, to some degree, his comedy is based on what he believes.
Yeah.
And that's okay. So I'm a bit, I don't know quite how to articulate that, but I see comedians or people who I feel are playing against social norms in a way that could be cruel, but I don't feel that they're doing it in a way that is ironic, which I think you need to be if you're going to be cruel. It's got to be something you're doing as performance rather than as statement.
Well, that's, and it's also got to be ridiculous too. Like the fact that somebody's saying that in such a way that, you know, it makes you laugh because of the ridiculousness of it. Like, I'm not in any way advocating that it's okay to make fun of somebody who's gay or somebody who's stupid or seemingly stupid, somebody who has a limb, missing a limb, any kind of thing that you can think of to make fun of somebody. It's not okay to do it if you're sitting there like legitimately making fun of that person because you think those things are wrong and stupid, you know, like, no, it's silly. If you're sitting there like, I'm trying to think of like the best example, Chris Evans, let's just say, you know, he's an actor and not a comedian, but clearly he is a feminist. He is an activist. He is, he fights for the rights for everybody. You know, he quite literally is Captain America. When you read his tweets, you know, this man stands up for everyone. You know, if he were to in some way make a joke about someone of some different faith, some different sexual orientation, some different race or whatever, you can get that, like you said, it's ironic, it's silly, and so on, and you can understand that. Whereas if somebody like Donald Trump were to make a joke about one of those same things, it wouldn't be funny because you know he means it.
Because I think, you know, I think sometimes it's because it's when comedians do it in a way where it feels right, it's when they're not making fun of the people or the issue, they're making fun of either, ironically, the person making the statement. So it's sort of it's bouncing back at making the person making those statements look stupid. Al Murray, the British landlord, pub landlord character that Al Murray does, where he sort of plays a sort of very little island, insular, nationalistic, ignorant man making all these wild statements about Europe in particular, is funny because he is sending up that persona. It's not what he actually believes. But so I think if you're making sort of comments on the person or the culture, or how culture considers these issues, I think that tends to be the way it plays best. Yet at the same time, I'm still cautious. Are we actually just placing our own restrictions on comedy by saying what works? What I don't know. But
well, and that's the thing. It's definitely an individual thing. It's up to the comedian who makes the jokes. They have to find it funny, and the people who think like that comedian will probably find it funny too. And I'm not saying that like everything that any comedian has ever said will always be funny or is always funny. You know, there are certain grounds. As a matter of fact, Would I Lie to You, I have read that the host, the original host, made a joke that even David and Lee called him out for, saying that's just not right. And that's exactly what I'm talking about, that there are lines that can be crossed. But I think it's quite, if it's done well, it's quite obvious that what's being said is just a silly little thing. You take it for the joke that it was for the 5 seconds and you move on, kind of thing, you know?
Because that's the beautiful thing about comedy, especially when you're doing to stand-up. I'm saying stand-up performers to some degree in the same things we talk about in panel shows, where they're not stand-up, but they're performing to an audience in a way that, that requires a skill. And I mean, one of the greatest people I find to watch is Stuart Lee, who's a British comedian, originally from Birmingham, I think, who is brilliant in his joke. His humour is very deadpan. It's very when he does articles for newspapers, it's almost very hard to tell where he's being serious and where he's being ironic. But he also deconstructs the art and the nuances of comedy and being a comedian and performing as part of his act. So he's there sort of deconstructing as much as he's constructing jokes. And I think it just sort of reminds you of how layered comedy is and how intricate the performance is. And if you do it like slightly wrong, like you say with Angus Deaton, who was, I imagine it, who it was for, how,
yes, yes,
Would I Lie to You, it'd be very easy to miss the beat or miss the way to articulate a joke, which if it was articulated in a slightly different way would have worked, but if it's done in slightly the wrong way, it wouldn't. So it's a very interesting medium, and yeah, I think it's a fascinating one to look at. And I think one of the things which I think is so brilliant about comedy in the States at the moment, and I'm doing this because you've been very kind to sort of say how great some of our panel shows are, is some of the late night talk shows in the States at the moment, is especially because they are such a foreground in commentating through satire about political events from all ends of the spectrum, although obviously at the moment very much at one end of the spectrum. But it just reminds me of how powerful comedy is, as because I think the beauty of comedy is that it is critical. If you're going to deliver a joke, you've got to be able to make sure the people believe the setup to the joke. So if you're talking about real life events, the way that I think you tend to see comedians who do this tend to be more left-wing or liberal, to use a dangerous word, is because there is that critical nature that you need to be critical to be able to make your argument, to set up the joke, to make the joke work. If you don't do that, it doesn't work. And sort of, it's very easy to poke fun at people like Donald Trump, but it's a lot what makes a really strong comedy satire is to be able to deconstruct the issues, the arguments, the performances, the rhetoric, and the culture that sits around a person, and then use that to create your argument in a funny way. But even though it's funny, it's the argument that sets it up that makes it work. And that should work on any political spectrum. It's not about it being about left-wingers being against right-wingers. It's about critical thinking, which tends to be a sort of more of a sort of liberal nature to it, not always, but that has a liberal sort of foundation to it, because you're questioning everything. You're not accepting everything as tradition. You're progressively questioning, which is the nature of that sort of comedy. And that can be aimed at anyone in any sphere, left or right. So it's a really brilliant medium, which America is making really engaging. And when I'm feeling frustrated that I can't articulate or I can't think what I'm feeling about certain issues in the world, going and sitting and watching John Oliver or Stephen Colbert to some degree, I preferred it when he was doing his ironic character, or Trevor Noah, I find it fascinating, not for the punches it's making on the topical political spectrum, but just in the way they articulate their points, which they would articulate, I would hope, to anyone on the political spectrum, if you see what I mean. It's just at the moment, It's there's a lot of places to punch. But I find that quite engaging, and that can make me feel a little better, because it's someone articulating and speaking to me about things that I want to get into my head. you know, why this is a problem. It would be easy just to laugh at the person and say, oh, Donald Trump's wrong, or this is done wrong, or Bernie Sanders should be doing this. But it's when you have people who have got that critical mind through comedy to break down why Trump or Bernie or Hillary or what a businessman or actor has done wrong, and then frame that in the joke by sort of breaking down what is absurd about the situation. And I think that's brilliant. And as I say, I think America's really leading the way in that. And I kind of wish we had a little more of that over here. We have satire, but that sort of very popular, forefront, engaging daily those issues. You know, Colbert's there virtually daily, reflecting on the news of that day. It's a really powerful medium to engage people, especially young people. So that's a positive in the world. What's about...
Go on, please. No, I was just going to say that it's nice to see that there are positives in the world right now, you know?
I think it is a positive, and I think we're going to look at positives. While there's some really negative engagement, as we've been talking about, through things like social media, especially if you read political threads, but as you say, even fandom is, and it always has been, but is very visually very depressing in the way it talks to itself. But there are engagements which are sort of very uplifting. Seeing how these, you know, that people are galvanized and are speaking. And like I said, it's not about it being political. It's about it being critical. That I find really good in comedy, in American comedy, is this critical nature is there, where it sets up and argues out a point as much as making the joke. And I think that's a really powerful way to get people engaged. And we need to get young people engaged. So I'm kind of hoping young people are watching the shows. But talk about pure escapism, and something we've both watched and we'll probably finish on is Spider-Man Homecoming.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're looking at sort of event engagement, sort of where you sort of go to the cinema and see a film to escape everything. And that can be a very powerful medium, isn't it? Because it shuts everything else down. You can't even talk to your friend about what this might relate to what. You've just got to sit and enjoy what is being presented to you. And is it just me? I mean, I don't know whether it's intentional or not, or whether it's the industry feeding off audience reactions, but certainly, and DC seems to be in a right mess over doing this, but Marvel seems to have worked out that at the moment people need that feel-good factor. And certainly since Guardians of the Galaxy and Ant-Man and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 and certainly Spider-Man, there seems to be a real... And Thor Ragnarok later this year seems to be following that vibe of a sort of, I don't know, a pulpy, fun, visually.
No, I see what you're saying. It's okay. I was going to say so many different things here, but you've got the original Spider-Man, not the original because there were obviously others before it, but the first big budget movie Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire. And as a huge Spider-Man fan, I liked them. They were good films, but I felt Tobey wasn't right for Spider-Man or even Peter. I felt that the character wasn't portrayed correctly. I felt the humor was missing from the character. And a friend of mine pointed it out to me a long time after that the movies themselves had humor, but the character did not, you know. And as my brother always said to me for years, he's like, yeah, the Spider-Man movies are okay, but there's only so many times I can watch Tobey Maguire cry. And it's like, wow, yeah, you're right. So then came along the Amazing Spider-Man films, and Andrew Garfield, I thought, made a better Spider-Man, made an interesting Peter Parker. It wasn't comic true because, you know, you had to update for the times and so on. I felt that we were going in the step in the right direction. You know, dramatic things were happening to Peter, but Peter could still be funny when he's Spider-Man, even though he wasn't 100%, but it was more than we got with Tobey. But the more I sat there and watched the films, they were so heavy because they put so much drama and so much weight on Peter's shoulders, which are in the comic. Mm-hmm. He always has drama and heavy weight on his shoulders, but they were told in such a way that I did realize watching like Iron Man and Captain America and the Avengers that while there's such life-threatening danger going on in those films, that with these two Amazing Spider-Man films, I felt things were too heavy to sit there and enjoy it as entertainment, certainly if you're watching with a child. Then comes along Tom Holland's movie. And the approach, hearing the approach they were going to take with, you know, the Breakfast Club kind of thing. What is that, John Watts? the director, if I'm not mistaken. Not John Watts. I can't think who it is. People will correct us if we can't get it. But it was such an, I remembered thinking when I heard it that I was like, I'm sorry. John Hughes. That's it. I remembered thinking, I don't know about this. I don't know. Like, I want to see Spider-Man be Spider-Man. Do I want to see a Breakfast Club Spider-Man movie? But it works. It works because it shows not only the serious stuff that happens to Peter, but also the absurdity that happens to Peter and, yes, and the awkward comedy that he has and the awkward stuff. Like, and what's beautiful about Peter's awkward comedy, his awkward moments, is it's not like The Office with the awkward comedy that kind of Ricky Gervais is made famous and is known for. You know, that stuff where, like, I can only watch so much of it at a time kind of thing. It was just done so well because it was Peter being true to himself, being that nerd figure, I guess, if we're going to use an old terminology there, who doesn't quite fit in and get along with everybody else, although he's trying. And he keeps having moments where he realizes, just like we all did growing up, every one of us, I don't care who you were and how cool you were, where you did something wrong and you realize, well, shoot, maybe that's not the thing I should have said, you know? And it was just done so well. And then even the weight on his shoulders, like all the things, like he's a kid who wants to have fun and fit in with his friends, but he's got these bigger things that he has to deal with because he feels he has to deal with them simply because he can, you know, and he has the ability and who else does, you know? And it was handled so well. I felt the movie was done so well. I felt they brilliantly realized a character who I never thought would have been translatable to film, and that's the Vulture. Mm. I thought they did such a great job with him. Michael Keaton did an amazing job there. I can sit here and I can tell you I have qualms with the movie. There are certain things that I wish they didn't do, or I wish they did differently, or that I felt detracted from the character a little bit. But as a whole, you sit there and go, but that's okay, because damn, was it good. And here he is in the cinematic universe that so far, the worst thing that I can say about it is that Thor 1 and 2 put me to sleep. You know, like, yes, it's that's about it. So, yes. But Thor 3 looks like it's going to be good, especially with the inclusion of Hulk, which, you know, that was their thought. You know, so, yes, it's working for you, and hopefully it'll work on film.
I was going to say that is interesting, that those early Marvel, those Marvel films, through Marvel Studios rather than the Spider-Man ones, through Sony, they didn't quite get the tone. They struggled a little, and I think they struggled, as you say, with Thor, because he's a very serious character in a lot of ways, and his universe is fairly stoic and serious. How do you bring lightness into it? And I think they, as you're right, I think they really struggled with him. Iron Man, I think Iron Man still had that seriousness, but they managed to lift it with having Robert Downey Jr. and his the way he played the character that sort of raised the game of it. So I think you're right. But more recently, I think that's given them the idea of how to play these sort of films, which feels really true to the comics, because there is that comic sort of vibe to them. And I like that. And I like this sort of... I mean, in fairness, even the old Spider-Man films, I mean, everyone has a go at the emo Spider-Man 3 with Tobey Maguire's emo. But he did do that in the comics. That was the sort of thing that did occasionally happen to him. When he had the black suit, he did sort of become that darker character, and he did do that. I mean, yeah, the dance scene was over the top, but the notion of it was invested within the roots of the concept. But I think now they seem to be finding that. Well, Marvel seems to be able to find that very easily. They seem to have worked it out. And like and Homecoming sort of spoke to so many levels, articulated so many levels of Spider-Man. There were the elements of Civil War Spider-Man there with the costume and Tony Stark. You had the Ultimate Spider-Man there with his best mate, who I think is Miles' best mate, I'm not sure. But that's sort of idea of having
an amalgamation,
They have that amalgamation there, so they play homage to that. The core values of what Spider-Man is there. The youth is in there from when he was young. You've got the, as you say, those wonderful little moments which they never really articulated, him messing up, you know, sort of stopping someone breaking into a car who wasn't breaking into a car. You know, retrieving a bike but then realising he doesn't know who it belongs to. Things like that, which is sort of very human. And then you have this lovely sort of this fatherly sort of situation between Robert Downey Jr. and Tom Holland, which works really nicely. And then just to top it off, you say the Vulture was played well. He wasn't an overt villain. He was a sort of, they were quite clever how they played him like that, where they gave him that sort of family sympathies, the working class values of trying to succeed, sort of ethos, I suppose, to some degree of traditional American business politics, you know, that you can all work your way to the top. And that's what he was doing in his own way. So there was just so many beautiful levels to it. And then it linked to this whole Marvel Universe, which gave it that comic backstory and that solid ground to build its story, that suddenly, you know, the Vulture could have this ridiculous high tech because it was taken and appropriated from the Avengers movie. So lots of clever ways of sort of making this a really fun, active, if a little long, movie. And yeah, I agree with you.
Well, there's a couple of great things about it too, is that one of the things that Marvel is lucky with right now with their cinematic universe is that they have all those years of history, you know, in some cases 75, 50, whatever, that they can draw from and go ahead and make this universe more connected in a way even better than they ever did with the comics, because the comics kind of was a retroactive connection. At some point, they decided all these individual titles should meet and become one universe. DC did the same thing. And so you do have things where, rather than having people like so many different characters be a billionaire genius like Iron Man, like Tony Stark, you don't have to have the Vulture or the Green Goblin all be these rich, evil megalomaniacs who create their suits. I loved the fact that the Marvel Universe is capitalizing on the Chitauri equipment right now. I think it's really wise, and I think people. Like, I had issues with the Tobey Maguire movies. I had issues with the Andrew Garfield movies. I felt each one was better than the last. I like the Garfield movies. I certainly am with everybody else that Spider-Man 2 was definitely a damn good film. But you have these... You're never going to get with a comic book movie 100% accuracy. You're not going to get it the way it was in the comics, because you can't. There isn't 100% accuracy. They've changed, even if you just stick with Spider-Man, just take Spider-Man from day one to now, they've changed it so many times, there isn't 100% accuracy. There are things that are going to have to change, because you have, in many cases, three films, sometimes, you know, like with Captain America, certainly Iron Man 6, 9, something, films to try and cram in 50 years or more worth of history, and you're just not going to do it. So what I love about this is that, you know, no one should be sitting there complaining that, you know, Spider-Man isn't exactly portrayed the way it was in the 60s, because guess what? It's not the 60s. You can't have a kid being a nerd type character in the 60s, being bullied by the bully type characters of the 60s in 2017. It just won't work. But also, it is its own entity. This is not the comic books just come to life. It is another reality of the comic books. It's if we bring in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy here for a moment, every version of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the radio drama, the TV show, the LP that came after the radio drama, the book, the movie, were different. And Douglas Adams had said he intentionally made them different because he felt that you should, anytime you adapt a same story to another medium, it should change in some way. It should be different. It should be new. And I found that very interesting, because I've always clung to, you know, I want Spider-Man to be Spider-Man on film. I want things to be the way they were, but you kind of can't. There's no real way to do it, but you can stick to the core values. You can stick to the core beliefs and the core ideas, and you can get what you love about that character. And this goes with any superhero or any adaptation on film.
This was something that Will Brooker, a scholar who has looked into Batman in way too much detail, I suppose. But one of the things I remember reading that he pointed out, which I liked, is he would sort of say, you know, if you're looking for quintessential Batman, you don't go back to the 40s. You won't find what Batman means to people in the origin or when it started. You know, there becomes a matrix which feeds all these ideas of these values of what the superhero means, and it can mean obviously different things to different people, which makes it even more complicated. Because Spider-Man to me in the early 90s when I was reading the comics was very different to Spider-Man as he is now. You know, who has the right, where you come in, and obviously, you know, we've talked about this in that other podcast with Doctor Who, it's the same sort of thing. And I think that is a problem, and I find it fascinating though to see how Marvel seems to have worked way into sort of making the film medium translated to film, and yet then look to see how they can translate film back into comic. And they're sort of doing this sort of multiplicity of films that all link together into this medium replicates the way the comics function to some degree. And to some degree, while it's been a failed franchise in other ways, the X-Men's faults have sort of kind of worked when it's replicating the medium of the X-Men. Because how many times has the X-Men timeline changed in the comics or re-altered? Which is exactly what they do in the films as well. Often unintentionally, I think, but it doesn't matter. And it's kind of funny to watch, in a horrid way, watch Warner Brothers and DC stumble constantly with their material because they just can't find the outlet. They can't find where to place it. They can't find the tone for it. They can't find, and even Gotham, I think, struggles, the TV show. And it is still quite enjoyable, but they can't find that comfort zone yet. And I think that's, and from what I hear, there's now reports coming out whether it's true or false. But the first rough cut of Justice League has been sort of like, oh my god, it's a mess. Now whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I could imagine it so, because, and to be fair, it is a difficult, DC's material is probably a little more cerebral. Yeah. It's gonna be a difficult one to adapt to this age of escapism. And especially, and I think unfortunately they made that massive mistake pushing Superman down the wrong direction in tone. And I think, yes, it's kind of funny how when we go back to when we were watching cartoons with, say, the DCAU with Bruce Timm taking on Superman and Batman as cartoons, how he and his team worked out very quickly that Superman should be a bright, colourful universe, Batman should be a dark noir. And they sit like that. And yeah, you can cross them over, but ultimately they are different. And I think that's the mistake that they've lost the way in the DC stuff, is that Superman... Yeah. Fits in the Batman universe and no longer carries the lightness and the spirit of what makes Superman interesting to people. And it's fascinating. And again, it all comes down to finding your mode of escapism. And maybe that's something that Justice League, that DC hasn't done, which Marvel has somehow found. And
well, you know, it's very interesting you say that too, because we may have mentioned this before, but growing up, I was always more into Marvel Comics than DC. DC, I liked Batman, and of course I loved the old Batman 60s TV show with Adam West. You know, that was just reruns. I grew up with that as a kid. Superman, I liked the old black and white TV show. Mm-hmm. And Christopher Reeves. Christopher Reeves was my Superman, you know? And that was it. That was really... Oh, and Wonder Woman, Linda Carter. I watched that as well. And that was my exposure to DC outside of the comic books, because I didn't really read the comic books. My brother was very into the comic books, but you know, I did very little with the comic books. I watched those, and then The Flash when that came around in the 90s. But now the new Flash TV show, Arrow, the Batman vs Superman, the new Wonder Woman movie, I don't have an interest. I don't have an interest in that world. That they don't speak to me. But any Marvel movie they're throwing at me, almost, they're going to get to a point where I don't really know the characters or may not be interested in watching them. You know, I found some of the Netflix series a little long to watch. Mm-hmm. And there's a big actual tonal shift that we could talk about there. But
yes,
the DC stuff just doesn't captivate me as much. Batman will always sell, and I think Batman generally would interest me. I will say, as much as I don't really kind of care to see Batman versus Superman, I'm kind of interested to see a Ben Affleck solo Batman movie. But will you get that? Or will it be like Marvel now, where Superman will have to show up in it, or Wonder Woman will have to show up in it? You know, and that's fine. I don't want to knock that, because if that's what you're doing with your cinematic universe, that's okay. Iron Man showed up in Spider-Man, and he wasn't as oppressive a figure as people thought he was going to be. They thought it was going to be like Iron Man 4 in a Spider-Man movie, and it wasn't. And that was great. That was perfect. And I think that's the thing. I think somehow, and Marvel has to trip up. I just can't imagine that somebody's luck or strategy is going to hold out so well. But so far, they're doing so well with their cinematic universe that through a few issues here or there where people wished, you know, say, Mandarin wasn't used as a joke.
Yeah.
You know, by and large, people enjoy it. And I don't mind the Mandarin thing, to be perfectly honest. I had kind of hoped that we were going to find out in a subsequent movie that maybe it was him and he was really just playing Tony all along or something like that. But I don't mind it. I think, you know, it's a very difficult one to bring in, because if you're going to bring the Mandarin into an Iron Man movie, what are you going to do? Is it going to be Chitauri technology again that Mandarin's using? Or are you going to introduce real magic and real mysticism with these rings? Marvel's universe, Marvel Cinematic Universe, is only touching that now, which means that if they really wanted to smooth talk Robert Downey Jr. into another Iron Man movie with that, you could, because you're finally getting to that point where it can be believable.
Yeah, it feels to me like as soon as they got the tone for Guardians of the Galaxy, they seem to find the tone from then on, and especially in their marketing as well. So Civil War, Doctor Strange, you know, as we've said, Ant-Man to a degree, maybe. I'm not sure if that came before. I can't remember now. There's so many. But it feels like, and certainly with Ragnarok, they seem to have got the right vibe, of the comic vibe and the fun vibe, and they're rolling with it. So, yeah, we'll just have to see where it goes. I would love, actually, when you said that, I was thinking I would love them to have done Spider-Man Homecoming as a 60s piece. That'd be really cool. And it obviously couldn't have linked, but I'd love to see a Spider-Man standalone, which was done in the 1960s. That would be really interesting.
That's something I wondered before. Like, when you think about it, the new Wonder Woman movie, that was primarily set in the 40s, if I'm not mistaken, and just like Captain America was, you know. And I thought about it, and if your difficulty is trying to bring those characters to the modern world, well, then put them in the world where they fit best.
Well, I don't know if we said it in this podcast, but I always felt that with James Bond, that it, you know, doing, you know, say, where do you take James Bond now? And you think, well, why don't you take him back to the 70s? Why, given these films have got no linear, real, any serious linear connection, or they can't, why not do one with set in 1966? You could even carry the same actor, whoever's going to be playing it next, could be this, you know, or if what's his name is playing it again, you know, could do it in a different era. That could really give it a vitalize, could really revitalize it. I think certainly Days of Future Past helped that with the X-Men franchise. That sort of gave them their feel. So yeah, so many ways. So yeah, I think that's what we're saying is that the Marvel Universe at the moment is a very good escapism spot.
Oh man, which, you know, is very interesting now. Like, I was thinking, okay, they're talking about Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
Bringing her into the Marvel Universe and so on. And, you know, we were all thinking that she's a part of Civil War and that would be her, not Civil War, Infinity War, and that would be her introduction the way that Spider-Man's was into the cinematic universe. And maybe it will be her introduction, but it won't be her beginning from what we're understanding they're doing, essentially, what you were saying. Because if I'm not mistaken from the rumors that are out there, that they're setting her films, at least her first one, in the 90s. So to say that she's been around for a while, which at first when I heard that, I was kind of like, no, I don't like that. Like the Marvel, well, even though Captain America was there, he died in the 40s. And then the Marvel Universe, the whole superhero thing kicked off with Iron Man.
Yeah.
You know, and I felt that was really how it should be because the world didn't understand superheroes or anything like that before. But I guess it depends on how they do it. You know, if they do it like Captain America, where she's there, people knew her for a blip, and then something happened, and then, whoops, here she is now in the modern day, I guess it could work. I guess it could make sense. But they kind of got it there. Somehow, for whatever reason, if this is true, they realized the 90s makes sense for this character, for this story. And, you know, same thing, like we just said, Captain America and Wonder Woman. I do want to backtrack real quick, though. I want to talk about something with Spider-Man, and this is going to be a big spoiler. So if anybody is listening and hasn't seen that movie, I would recommend that you stop listening now or skip ahead and maybe skip far ahead because I can ramble. But one of the things that I have to say that Spider-Man Homecoming did that I have not had a movie do or a TV show do in quite a long time for me, because I'm usually very good at guessing plots and figuring things out, was throw that curveball at me that when Peter goes to pick up his date for the dance, there's the Vulture answering the door. And we all, the entire theater, everyone went, oh, crap. Like a collective gasp had happened in the theater. And I just thought, well played. Somehow they kept that secret. You know, while the internet was trying to guess who MJ was, Michelle, who the character Michelle, she was really Mary Jane or whatever, you know, they were all so preoccupied with that, they got that one over us. They pulled it the wool over our eyes, as it were. And it's so perfect for Peter's life because so many of his villains are connected to him in some kind of personal way.
Yes.
And you get that with the Green Goblin in both Spider-Man and the Amazing Spider-Man franchises. And even Doc Ock and Doc Connors, who have become like friend mentor type characters. You know, here, this was a curveball because here was a totally unrelated character who just happened to be somebody that Peter feels he should stop. And then right there, the main thing that is at the core of somehow Peter's life all the time is that Spider-Man and Peter Parker are not separate lives. They are always connected. And no matter what, they are always connected. And that's the weight on his shoulder. It worked so well. And I have to give that major props because, like I said, I didn't see it coming. And I'm surprised I didn't see it coming. Being such a Spider-Man fan, I should have realized some kind of connection was coming. But they did so well with that, and I really liked Tom's reaction in the car with Michael Keaton in that scene. I kind of liked, rather than him being the big bad, like how Tony would have done in the face of Loki, you know? And I know that Tony had his own kind of quiet moments when somebody bested him, you know? But I liked it that Peter sat there and was just like, well, what do I do? You know, like, I can't save my family right now, so I just have to give up. And it was great, so well played by both of them. Such a great moment.
Of course, seeing it in a British cinema, there was no gasps whatsoever. Everyone just watches silently. But it surprised me. I was trying to work out what was going to be the trick there. I thought it was going to be something like he was going to find out that it was all a joke and she wasn't going to go to the prom with him or something. And yeah, then
sure,
it was very, very well played, and Keaton plays that beautifully in the car. I have one final question to roll us out on, and this is one that I've not seen anyone ask yet, so I'm going to ask it of you. This Christmas, we have the second of the new Star Wars films. Is there a danger in them trying to sort of, obviously trying to nurture an Empire Strikes Back, feeling once again the inability to go on their own direction without having to reference what's been done before, and also audiences expecting them to reference tones of what's been done before?
Sure.
Is there a danger in some of the things which are, I don't know whether they're leaking, but people are talking about, is there a danger that at the moment we do need escapism, and is this actually, could this be more of a browbeater than fun? I mean, there's a lot of talk about Skywalker and Luke being a sort of very much at the moment being the antithesis to the Jedi, maybe even an antagonist. I don't know whether that's true or not, and I certainly don't want to be spoiled about it, but these sort of talks, if they went down this route, is this where, oh, you know, 1998, it's where I'd want Star Wars to go. Right at this moment, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's okay. There's definitely a danger that they would look back and see that if you're doing a trilogy, the middle has to be a low point, and it worked so well with Empire Strikes Back, so why not do it? I think a lot of the fear out there right now is that, you know, The Last Jedi would do what The Force Awakens did and be too much of a carbon copy of what had come before. And while a lot of people are really upset with The Force Awakens for doing that, I still maintain that it was a brilliant move for JJ to have done, because coming after the prequels, what he did with The Force Awakens reassured us that the world that we were in was indeed the world of Star Wars. I feel director Rian Johnson, especially from what I have seen, is deliberately making every attempt to make this movie something new and different, in the respect that he's not going to tread on old ground and show us so many of those same callbacks and similarities. I do feel that, even though I feel that's the case, that ending the movie on a low point would make sense, because, I mean, how can you end the movie at, I mean, they didn't even end The Force Awakens really at a high point. You know, Star Wars did. Star Wars ended like the whole universe was great. It was the only movie. There was no sequel. They beat the Death Star. They beat the Empire. But The Force Awakens didn't end with that feel. The Force Awakens already kind of had an Empire kind of ending to it. But it does make sense that, you know, you can give them a minor win, but some kind of loss has to happen, because where are we going to go in the next movie if everything's great and hunky-dory? So I do kind of feel that we will get an Empire Strikes Back in the sense that it needs to end on some kind of a sour note to make us want to see what's coming next and how everything will come out good in the end. But I don't have this fear that it's going to be a rehash of Empire.
Well, I'm not saying it's going to be a rehash, but what I'm saying is that I think because they obviously feel, I mean, okay, as you say, in the sense of literature, you were talking about second act tends to end on a down point that moves towards the finale of the third act. That's usual. But there's this sort of feeling that they've got to go darker, like because Empire was darker. And there's the feeling that that sort of structure is almost expected. And I'm just wondering how they're going to do it. And obviously we lost Han Solo in The Force Awakens, yeah, which, you know, was obviously something the actor wanted to do. I didn't think they did it particularly well, personally, but they did it. And I'm just wondering whether, as I say, going back to the theme of escapism, I'm wondering how they deal with Luke Skywalker. Could be quite, in a sense, not important, because it's not important, but from an escapism point of view, if they do, like, it wasn't the Dark Empire series, the comic book series where they had him go to the dark side and they had the Emperor clones. Could they be going down that route where they're sort of trying, because it's new and we're trying to do something dark, yeah, are they just going to end up subverting all the characters which people are going to go and see? And I do wonder whether one of the mistakes they did with the first one, I mean, whether Solo being killed off was a mistake or not is up to you as the individual, yeah, to decide. But there was always that talk of cutting all of Skywalker's scenes out, the scripted scenes, because he was allegedly meant to have scripted dialogue in it, and ending it on a handover of the mantle, or the hand back of the mantle, maybe. Sort of cheated the people who were going to escape of what they really were looking to escape with, if you see what I mean.
Here's the thing for me. I think what directors and writers are thinking here is that, and I kind of agree with this, where right off the bat I will say, I don't think we're going to get a Luke Skywalker that's embracing the dark side, that is evil, like people are thinking is going to happen. I personally don't see that. But what I think more so is going to happen is, when Star Wars first happened, the title, when you think about it, A New Hope, which did come later, you know, it talks about Luke Skywalker basically being this hope, or these people, these three people that have come together, four, five, six, however you want to count them, with droids and Wookiees, coming together to be a new hope to save the universe. But more so, think about it in terms of Luke Skywalker. He was a very hopeful young kid. Everything that he saw was very bright. Jedis are going to save the universe. Ben is this great man who's going to save the universe. We're going to go save a princess. You know, I'm going to do great things. I'm going to be a pilot. You know, and he was being bogged down by his uncle, but he had all these great and vibrant ideas that were wonderful, and he really believed in what was going to happen, and he believed in the Empire. I think if you're going to reintroduce Luke Skywalker into the franchise again as his new starting point, we haven't seen him now in 30 years or so, aside from, you know, a 2-second blip of him just staring. It would make sense to start with Luke, especially with what happened, with whatever happened with Kylo Ren and the Jedi school and Luke, that he's going to start at a very sour note, that I had all this hope. I defeated the Empire. I took down the big bad. We saved the universe. Everything was supposed to be great, but look, it's not great. It's not wonderful. My school has been destroyed. The kids have been destroyed. The Jedi and the Sith, it's a big battle. It sounds like it's apt to start with Luke having lost his hope and having to gain it again by the end. My belief is that I don't think that we're going to keep seeing a succession of our favorite characters from the original trilogy die per film. And of course, we've lost Carrie Fisher outside of the film, so there's no choice there but to deal with her somehow on film, unfortunately, either having died or just having little screen time. But I feel what they're going to do with Luke is kind of bring things around to show that in the end there was hope again, and that Rey and Finn and so on brought it all back, and that Luke was right, there was just bad times to come. And I don't think that that's a bad way to do it, because obviously we all watched Return of the Jedi. There was that great ending. they won, wonderful, and then we get The Force Awakens, and it's like, well, what the hell happened to that good ending? Why did you take it away? What's the point of everything now? And I guess if that's what you're going to do, if you're going to take away that happy ending, you have to work toward giving it back to us. And I personally think it makes sense. And that's what I think is going to happen with Luke Skywalker, rather than him be evil in any way and anybody have to fight him or turn him back. I think it's more so just a broken man, to be honest.
Oh, we will see. I think that's all we have time for, which sounds positively 1980s. And that's not a bad thing, maybe. I hope you've enjoyed this. I don't think there's any conclusions to be made, except enjoy your escapism. I think we all need to escape. As we were saying before this podcast, of course, we all need to be active as well and be aware of things going on around us. So it's not about hiding from the world, but there are times where you just need to escape your personal problems or global problems or whatever. And it's great to see that, you know, what sort of shows do that for you, be it the wonderful Golden Girls or Seinfeld or panel shows or Marvel films. There'll be comment sections, I'm sure. You can put your own opinions on what you like to see, what sort of gives you a happy vibe to escape. Might be this. I mean, we didn't talk about audio. I mean, I've been listening for the Doctor Who Companion. I've been listening to some Big Finish stuff, which has been really nice just to sit, listen to 20 minutes on a wireless headset, you know, with my eyes shut, and that's a lovely escapism. But we didn't go down that route, and obviously you've been doing with Hitchhikers. So yeah, just let us know what you think. We'll be back in some form or another whenever some form or another is next time. The only definitive thing we know about it is it will be next time.
This is a Beyond Cast Cerberus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCastCerberus.com.